Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Well, I want to start with some truth and packaging. This is going to be a really lame debate, and so for three reasons. Neither of us were college debaters, and so we really don't know what the hell we're doing. Secondly, the resolve states that humor is, you know, is good for politics, and I'm actually attacking that, and I'm the affirmative, and it's completely upside down. And then thirdly, a really good debate has to have two sides of equivalence so that there can be a real dialectic, and this debate doesn't have that. It only has one side that it makes any sense at all, and that's my position. How many of you are Jon Stewart fans? You ought to be ashamed of yourself. And that's the thesis that I'd like to present today. But first, I'd like to show you just a quick clip to put you in the
Springfield National Forest. So basically, what we want to do is cut her down.
Uh-huh.
As you can see in our artist's rendition, it's full of old growth, just aging and festering away. In comes our logging company to thin out the clutter. It's all part of nature's, you know, cycle.
Well, Jerry, you're a whale of a lobbyist, and I'd like to give you a logging permit. I would, but this isn't like burying toxic waste. People are going to notice those trees are gone.
Congressman, this is where it gets awkward. I never quite know how to put this. I just want to...
Offer me a bribe? what is it?
It's that little girl from Springfield who wrote the essay. Could be a good photo op.
Sure, fine.
So, where do we...
Not here. I've got a little place that I use for these matters. Call me tonight. Well, hi there. You must be Lisa Simpson.
Hello, sir.
Lisa, you're a doer. And who knows, maybe someday you'll be a congressman or a senator. We have quite a few women senators, you know.
Only two, I check.
You're a sharp one. Well, how about a few pictures? Tot shot always plays in the sticks. Oh, isn't that nice? Now, there is a politician who cares.
If I ever vote, that'll be for him.
I'm going to give you four jokes. After a quick meet and greet with King Abdullah, Obama went off to Israel, where he made a quick stop at the manger in Bethlehem, where he was born. This is about John McCain. He looks like a guy who backed over his own mailbox. He looks like the guy at the supermarket who is confused by the automatic doors. He looks like the guy at the movies whose wife has to repeat everything. Jay Leno. See, I got to admit, as a comedian, I'm going to miss President Bush because Barack Obama is not easy to do jokes about. He just doesn't give you a lot to go on. See, so this is why God gave us Joe Biden. And also from Leno, of course, a lot of famous sound bites were remembered by this campaign. There were some good ones. Barack Obama saying, "We are the change that we seek." John McCain saying, "I would rather lose an election than lose a war." Sarah Palin saying, "Do you have this in size 6? Humor is wonderful for the soul, and I recommend that you get as much humor in life as possible, except when it comes to politics. Political humor oftentimes is a mask of political cynicism, and that's what I want to talk about today. We live in an age of cynicism. Most people allege that they don't like cynicism. But they do. Our cynicisms are crushing us, our political spirit, and I think that that's not good. And I think to fix things, you have to understand political cynicism, and I'd like to make a short case as to what qualities cynicism have in politics and what might be done about it. I did a little study, not one of the fancy studies that Lance did, but this is just sitting and putting in a phrase into the Google search engine, and I put in sources of hope in quotation marks. And then I put other words in. So for example, I put in poetry, and I got 29,300 hits. I put in Entertainment, 27,400 hits. Alcohol, 21,100 hits. Humor, 20,800. Work, 16,300. Family, 14,400. Friends, 11,600. Baseball, 9,630. Doctors, 9,160. Psychiatrists, 8,450. Cats, 2,760. Dogs, 2,740. I don't know why, but cats appear to be better. I put in the Presbyterian Church, 2,600 hits. I put in politics, 856. I put in drugs, 710. So politics did better than drugs. And then I put in gerbils, and there were only six hits. I don't know what that means, but I thought I should add it. What I want to ask is why it feels good to feel bad about politics. And I do believe that it does feel good to feel bad about politics, and there are people who make us feel bad about politics so that we'll feel good. And a lot of them are political humorists, and I think they threaten us to the core of our very beings. But I want to give you a definition of cynicism. I define it as a fervent belief in human frailty and institutional corruption, and accompanied by an overwhelming need to predict mass unhappiness. It's a fervent belief, so it's a kind of a religious entity to it, in human frailty. And so this is an Old Testament God, not a New Testament God. In institutional corruption, and I think a lot of cynics have a kind of bucolic mentality that says, you know, if we could just go out there in the pasture with the cows, the world would be a better place, and all of this society stuff is not good. And then there's a need to predict mass unhappiness, and prediction, the need to say it first. And the political cynic is always one who wants to be the first one to figure out where the corruption is and to let everybody know. And then mass unhappiness, we're all going down together. In a lot of ways, political cynicism is the need to deliver your own eulogy and the eulogy of the nation you're surrounded. I think there are certain characteristics of cynicism that are important that we don't pay much attention to. For one thing, cynicism is a language. It's a language that is taught and practiced and perfected. I submit to you that no child is born cynical. This is something that we teach. Just like we teach other kinds of language devices, we teach people how to be cynical. Cynicism is contagious. I think no one living alone on an island would be cynical. It's something that we force upon one another, and it's a disease we try to intentionally share. It's a kind of fragile quality. It's not a natural condition, I submit to you, and that's why we need so much reinforcement all the time, and that's where political cynicism, political humor comes in, because it is a constant dose of reinforcement for this need that we have. It's also destabilizing. Peter Sloterdijk, a brilliant writer on Weimar Germany before Hitler, said during this time before Hitler, the expectation of being deceived had become a universal state of consciousness. And what Sloterdijk says is that kind of cynicism set people up for one answer. And Adolf Hitler provided that answer. And another characteristic of cynicism, I think, is that it promotes selective memory. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. Well, why, given all these qualities, why would cynicism be attractive? For one thing, it provides communal coinage. It's a way of making contact with one another. Some people say, you know, you can't go to a cocktail party in the suburbs and talk about politics or religion. That's not true. You can always talk about politics. You can simply say, well, what do you think this city council's doing to us? Well, I know what you mean. Yeah, absolutely. And this governor, oh, don't tell me about the governor. All right. What's your name? My Joe. You want to play golf next week? It's a perfect way of building community. Cynicism is media sanctioned. Television teaches us how to be cynical and how to talk cynically, and that helps as well. Cynicism also helps with age anxiety. It took me a while to think this through, but cynicism is great because if you're young, being politically cynical makes you seem old, mature, sophisticated. If you're older, it makes you feel young. hip, cool with it. And so it's like a perfect gift. It allows all people to make this kind of age transfer. There is a why the rise in cynicism. A lot of people have speculated about this, a decline in parental socialization about politics. There's a good deal of evidence that that's true. Decline in, of funding in schools for civic courses, civics courses. The media, the privatization of the media, people moving away from common, the common wheel and becoming individualized. Economic problems certainly sap people's faith in the political system. And then John Stewart. One of the things that's interesting about cynicism, if you listen really carefully to political cynics, is they spend most of the time focusing on motive. Not behavior, motive. Not what did they do, but why did they do it? Well, we all love to talk about motive, right? Because it's there. And one of the wonderful things about, well, actually, there's several things about motive that makes it terrific. Motives are mysterious. They are, and they're also undeterminable. Nobody has ever seen a motive, you know. We speculate about motives, and because we speculate about them and then we pronounce them, we cannot be proven wrong because nobody can get our data because we didn't have any data to begin with. And so it's great to talk about political motives. You can never be proven wrong. There's no bottom line in the world of political cynicism. Television is one of the best delivery systems for political cynicism. And let me just give you a few facts, studies that have been done over the years. In general, watching a political speech on television makes people twice as negative as seeing it in person. And this study's been done in a number, done by Wolf Donsbach, and he's done it in a number of different geographical locations. What he basically did is take this half of the audience, and he'd say, I'd like you to go to a room. This half of the audience, go to another room. This half of the audience, they go and they listen to a live political speaker give a talk. This group would be in another room. They would get the speech on television. And by and large, after time, the group that watched that on television was more negative than the group that watched it live. And the only thing that was different is they watched it on television. So television provides us a set. When you take it in, you're ready for the delivery system of cynicism. In general, the more we watch television, the less we know about current affairs. A lot of studies have shown that. In general, the more we depend on television news, the less news we know, less we know about the news of the day. And so we know less, and we're really, really sure about what we know. In general, the more we watch television, the surer we are about politicians. In general, the more you watch politicians on television, the more you dislike them. In general, and this is probably one of the most important points I'd like you to take away. In general, people react to the news as if it were representational rather than exceptional. As if it were representational rather than exceptional. And the whole point about news is that it's like news. Like it doesn't happen all the time. It happens very rarely. That's why you see nightly news, a crash on the interstate. And it's there. Why is it there? Not to depress you, but it's because it is rare. It doesn't happen all the time. It's news. But people watching the news say, oh my God, I'm never going to drive a car again. Look at all this stuff that's happening on. No, that's not. It was one instance. In fact, the great majority of people drive every single day and they do not get into a fatal accident on the highway. And that's the same with politicians, right? Illinois had a hard time with their governors recently. Three out of the last six have gone to jail. But if you multiply six times 50 states, that's 300, that's 300 governor types that have gone through the system in that time. And three out of 300, one out of 100, has had legal problems. That's not good. But it's one out of 100. But it gives us the sense that political crime is happening all over the place. I recommend to you a different course of being. A lot of people will say, well, I don't want to be adult. And the difference between, there's a great difference between skepticism and cynicism. Skepticism is a scientific vision. If someone does a study here in Santa Barbara in chemistry department, and puts out some results, I know that someone at University of Texas is going to go and try to replicate that study. And it's not because they distrust the guy at Santa Barbara. It says, you know, hey, who knows? Maybe it was the too much sun in Santa Barbara. Maybe there were the mist. Maybe the whales made a difference in this experiment. And so let's put it in Texas where there are no whales and see if that made a difference in the study. That's a scientific vision. It's skepticism. It's trying out things in different ways. People's sensory powers are limited. Therefore, they have to worry that their senses can deceive them, so they keep getting more data. People are fallible, and so you don't trust one person. You trust a group consensus instead. People are impulsive, and so it's good to exercise caution. These are all things that a skeptic believes in. Conventional wisdom is often wrong. That's why they call it conventional and not wisdom sometimes. And your senses can often deceive you, and those are all good things. And so, and most data come to us in a mediated way, and that's important to realize the filters that come to us. Cynicism, on the other hand, is a completely different model. Cynicism says that fate, not human action, determines life's outcomes. Observation is better than involvement. Believing in human malevolence is somehow satisfying, and irony is the only stable source of pleasure. There are alternatives to political cynicism, I think political hope. I think this president has shown us what political hope can do, and it can motivate, and it can move people and ideas and policies. And institutions are oftentimes attacked by political cynics, and yet without institutions, we wouldn't be who we are or where we are. Institutions are terribly important. Human imagination foresaw the need to create things, and then it did it. And group effort produces institutions. And the ravages of time can't reduce them because they are institutionalized. And institutions, I submit, do more good than bad and always have when they adjust to change. So I urge you to find a way of being that is not cynical. And here are some reasons. Cynics age hard. And I think we know that none of us want to age, or at least look like we're aging. Cynicism is an indulgent emotion. We can't afford it. Democracy takes all of us to make sense. And most importantly, someone will profit from your cynicism. If you become politically cynical and disengaged, then you have to ask yourself, well, now why would someone want to deliver political cynicism to me? What are the effects of that? Well, it'll decrease the number of people that will become involved in politics, and why would they want to do that, and who would they be, and who will profit? And so I tell my students, you know, if you don't vote, then I get 2 votes. And if you and your sister don't vote, I get 3 votes. And so any force, like political cynicism, that keeps people from the ballot box is something to be worried about. Bill Bennett wrote a book several years ago called The Book of Virtues. A lot of virtues in it, terrific virtues: self-discipline, responsibility, work, courage, perseverance, honesty, and faith. Terrific virtues, every one of which can be practiced alone in a closet. Political virtues are very different. Cooperation, civility, generosity, negotiation, tolerance, imagination, regularity, and compromise. You can't do any of those things alone in a closet. It takes people working with one another in a polity to get them done. I want to give you 10 guaranteed ways of sleeping well tonight. I want you to presume that what you read in the newspaper is an exception and not a rule. I want to encourage you to love politicians because they are our only option. I encourage you to laugh with people and not at them. I encourage you to get a lot of sleep because hope takes effort. I would urge you not to buy any book that contains the phrase crisis of democracy. Don't watch Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, or Stephen Colbert. Act your age. If you're young, I want you to think about the possibilities in front of you. If you're older, I want you to think about the wonders you've witnessed. Don't talk about people's motives. You don't know what the hell you're talking about. But when you do talk about politics, talk about it as if there were a 9-year-old overhearing you. Thank you.
How can a guy that funny be down on comedy? I don't understand. It just doesn't seem right. You know, I agree with just about everything that Rod has said, except for the main premise and question in this particular panel, which is, does comedy lead to cynicism? What if comedy provides us with the same level of insight and appreciation as Rod's humor provided for his argument in his talk? Can we have the projector back on? So I'm going to argue that putting John Stewart and others on trial for cynicism is the wrong charge. In fact, we might want to celebrate them for providing us with political interest and attention. So here's the question before us. Does political comedy breed cynicism? Is John Stewart an avatar of debilitating political cynicism or a motivator of skeptical engagement and active political participation? And the choices are clear. Rod prefers John Stewart number one, and I'm going to convince you that John Stewart number two is closer to reality. So I'm going to introduce something into this debate that Rod left out: evidence. This is a hall of learning, so we should bring that in. First of all, we have studies, yes, scientific studies, showing that late-night comedy viewing, Leno, Letterman, or Stewart, or Maher, increases attention to elections, increases the attention that people pay to elections. Comedy audiences consume more news and become more informed, and I would argue, put what they're consuming from the news, which on its own, as I will show in a minute, with more evidence, does leave us cynical. Comedy enables people to overcome that cynicism and develop perspective. And The Daily Show is actually the program that has the most informed viewers who pay the most attention to elections and other political issues. And I'm giving you sources should you want to run off to the library right after this talk. So I'd also like to argue, cynical compared to what? I mean, Rod and I completely agree that just watching the news alone could leave you terribly, terribly close to suicidal most days. On the other hand, if you stay up until 11 o'clock, you might go to bed with a better sense of the world. Exposure to news alone does breed cynicism. Rod is quite right on that. There are lots of studies to that effect. And as a result of that, news audiences are shrinking and often blame negativity and journalistic and political cynicism as the reason for leaving the news. Comedy and comedy audiences, by contrast, acquire perspective that enables them to process the news and act upon it in different and, I think, more positive ways. So what we've come to learn then is that whereas journalists often have difficulty sorting out the truth, comedians have developed something better than the truth, truthiness. And here's one of my favorite moments of truthiness. If you recall back in sort of this middle Iraq war era, where newspapers kind of reported the story right from the Bush administration script, and later the leading papers in the country, the Washington Post and the New York Times, actually apologized to their readers in quite a moment of sober reality checking on their part. They said, "We kind of blew it. Sorry, readers. We missed the story. We took it from the administration. The Democrats didn't stand up to give us another side to the story, and so you got a kind of a biased view of weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda connections and all of those things." And one of the things that was, I think, the moment of light on this was when Stephen Colbert was invited to address the National Press Club at their annual dinner with the president on the dais. And here's what Colbert said in his speech. It was quite a long speech, so this is like 30 seconds of it, to the journalists in the audience. "Let's review the rules. Here's how it works. The president makes the decisions. He's the decider. The press secretary announces those decisions, and you people in the press type those decisions down. Make, announce, type. Just put them through a spell check and go home. Get to know your family again. Make love to your wife. Write that novel you've got kicking around in your head. You know, the one about the intrepid Washington reporter with the courage to stand up to the administration? You know, fiction. Well, Washington was scandalized by Colbert. In fact, he was so scandalized that next year at the Washington White House Correspondents' Dinner, they invited a hack comedian, whom I actually thought had died, but was still playing the Poconos, and they brought him in, and it was so bad, it was not even laughable, that the New York Times actually canceled its attendance at the next year's dinner out of embarrassment for the whole affair. Here's an example of speaking truthiness to power that I think many of you have seen. How many of you have seen Jon Stewart's appearance on Crossfire? How many of you remember Crossfire? Well, there's a reason some of you may not. Let's look at this. Sorry about the quality of this. This was my first ever effort at editing a video. Unfortunately, the quality that I started with wasn't particularly great.
Thank you very much. Very kind of you to say. See, the thing is, we need your help. Right now you're helping the politicians and the corporations, and we're left out there to mow our lawns.
You just said we're too rough on them when they make mistakes.
No, you're not too rough on them. You're part of their strategies. You're partisan, what do you call it, hacks. I'm here to confront you because we need help from the media, and they're hurting us. And it's now, the idea is
if they're done, let me get this straight.
That this you're doing theater when you should be doing debate, which would be great.
You do no, it's
not
true.
Honest. What you do is not honest. What you do is partisan hackery. And I'll tell you why
John
I know
Kerry
it.
On your show and you sniff his throne and you're accusing us of partisan hackery?
Absolutely.
You've got to be kidding me.
You're on CNN. The show that leads into me is puppets making crank phone calls. What is wrong with you?
Well, I'm just saying there's no reason for you. When you have this
thing that I want to say is, when you have people on for just knee-jerk, reactionary talk...
Wait, I thought you were going to be funny. Come on, be funny.
No, I'm not going to be your monkey.
Go ahead.
I watch your show every day, and it kills me.
I can tell you love
it. It's so painful to watch. Because we need what you do. This is such a great opportunity you have here to actually get politicians off of their marketing and strategy. Yeah, it's someone who watches your show and cannot take it anymore. I just can't.
What's it like to have dinner with you? It must be excruciating. Who would provide you better material to dispose?
I don't really know. It's kind of not how we look at it. We look at the absurdity of the system provides us the most material, and that is best served by sort of the theater of it all, you know, which... By the way, thank you both, because it's been...
So that was a moment of political comedy that actually cut through, I think, what a lot of people see and that Jon Stewart actually expressed for them. And here's the consequence of that moment of comedy. Crossfire was canceled. Not long after, and Tucker Carlson, who's still floating around somewhere on cable, separated his association with that program. What I'd like to do is step back from this truthiness to a larger perspective on why comedy is so important in a very much changing mediascape. As I said before, people are leaving the news because they feel it's too cynical. Young people are leaving it faster than any other demographic group. More young people are going newsless today than any other demographic. Under 24 are the most newsless group in trend terms over the last 10 years. That doesn't mean that young people are less informed, however, and that's an interesting distinction. There are new ways of getting information through the noise of our changing mediascape, and that's what I'd like to talk about. One of the things in this mediascape that is changing is that genres are blurring, that comedy and news kind of need each other in order to reach complete understandings. Now, let me show you an example of that.
Here's a little clip from Saturday Night Live last night, Tina Fey portraying Governor Sarah Palin. Now, just watch this because I'm going to explain. I haven't seen anything like this in a while. Listen to this.
Ultimately, what the bailout does is help those that are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, to help. It's got to be all about job creation, too.
All right. Now, that was Tina Fey. But here's the real Sarah Palin earlier in the week in the interview with Katie Couric.
Ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, helping the... Oh, it's got to be all about job creation, too.
Right. That was the first time, John, I've ever heard the parody on Saturday Night Live actually use exactly what was said during the course of the week. It was a rough week for her this week.
Not sure if that's art imitating life or life imitating art there as you watch. Look, everyone inside the McCain campaign will tell you, Wolf, in a private conversation, they thought that interview was simply a disaster. They won't say that publicly, but they will tell you that privately.
And how about that Bobby Jindal? Just when we thought we didn't have Sarah Palin anymore. The mediascape is changing. It came up a little bit in the last session, but I think that this is the media of, these are the media of the future. If you notice the online world, look at where the conventional mainstream media are in terms of monthly visits. And this trend is only going to continue to grow, and the conventional media are going to continue to drop out of the picture. But the interesting thing is that digital media are convergent, and they involve participatory content creation and sharing on the part of the audience, which means, really, that the blurring of genres is the natural evolution of information. The Obama channel on YouTube in November 08 actually beat out Britney, beat out Beyonce, and beat out Machinima, the perennial leaders in YouTube audience share. Obama had the biggest YouTube audience in November. So as I said, digital media are participatory media, which means that these boundaries between news and other kinds of information and comedy really don't make sense because audiences decide what makes sense. Audiences decide how to create, share, and react to comment and content. So look at YouTube views. Obama had over 100 million YouTube views. One estimate had that 3 billion views of all video from all sources by all Americans who were participating in this media experience during the election. Some of this is very serious content of the sort you can't get on TV, or very few people get on TV, without a journalist talking over it in a 10-second soundbite telling you what the Obama race speech was about. 7 million people, roughly the size of a nightly TV news audience, actually watched that speech directly and then commented on it in the blogosphere afterwards. Some of the content is not so serious. Even more people watch this. And Obama and Obama Girl actually appeared together at a political rally. So how do you sort it out? Why would we want to sort it out when it's not sorting out in reality? So there are new ways to experience and share political speeches. This was the most watched video of all in the 08 election. How many of you saw Yes We Can, the music video by Will.i.am? Please go online and watch it. Time doesn't permit playing it now, but it's really quite an impressive and widely shared piece of campaign art. And then it spawned this sort of thing, which is also quite entertaining and charming in its own way. So one of the things that is important to understand is how content is distributed digitally in viral terms across multiple networks of participant audience. And one of the things I'd like to share with you is how many of you remember all the way back to the year 2000, that wonderful Bud Beer commercial called Was Up? Well, Was Up became a kind of an underground hit in a way because it reflected the use of a term that many of us used in our daily lives and could attach our own experiences to and share it with our friends. So here's the original commercial. And there's a reason I'm showing you a beer commercial, I promise you.
Hello? Hey, who? What's up? Nothing, V. Just watching the game, having a bud. What's up with you?
Nothing.
watching the game, having a bud.
True, true.
What's up? What's up?
Yo, who's that?
Yo, you pick up the phone.
Hello?
What's up?
What's up?
Yeah. Yo, where's Dookie?
Yo, Dookie.
Yo.
What's up?
What's up?
Hold on. Hello?
So what's up, B? Watching the game, having a bud.
True. True.
Okay, the first guy you saw in the commercial was the producer-director. He's the filmmaker who made that commercial. It was actually an art school film that was so entertaining that it was converted into a beer commercial. The art school film wasn't a beer commercial. It was everything but the bud, so to speak, in that commercial. So here's what happened to that meme in 2008. And so here we are with the same guys 8 years later.
Fundamentals of our economy are strong, but these are very, very difficult times. And we've always believed that our best days are ahead of us.
Hello.
What's up, B?
Nothing. Lost my home. Looking for a job. What's up with you?
Still in Iraq. Watching my ass.
True. True.
Yo, who's that?
Hold on for a second. Yo, pick up the phone.
Yo, forget the phone. I need painkillers. You got money for painkillers?
Just pick up the phone.
Hello?
What's up?
What's up? Oh. Yeah.
Where's Dookie?
Hey, yo, Dookie!
Pick up the phone! Dookie! Pick up the phone!
Hello?
So what's up, B?
Change. That's what's up. Change.
So you decide where the line is between information and getting the attention of people who are disconnecting from conventional information sources, and if that's an appropriate new way to reach very large numbers of people, which this ad did, and of course they had to put this little disclaimer at the end. That wasn't a Bud commercial. And one of the things that's interesting about these new digital experiences that merge comedy and information is that they're all over the blogosphere. In fact, we've tracked a number of these viral videos from inception to sort of disappearance. And the purple, the light line, is the blogging. And in most cases, the blogging leads the viral distribution. So bloggers see it, spread the links, and then people watch it and blog about it some more. And of course, there's no line between the blogosphere and the mainstream media any longer. And so you get an interaction there as well. Charles Stone is the guy who produced both of those films. So what's the bottom line here? It seems to me what's important is that if participatory media are now becoming the norm for younger citizens, and I believe that that's the case, look at these figures. This is the percentage of under 40-year-olds vote that the Obama campaign got in the most unlikely places: South Dakota, Alabama, Kentucky, Kansas, Republicans take note. Texas, 54%. South Carolina, 55%. And then you see states that were unlikely but went for Obama. North Carolina, look at the percentage of under 40 votes, 72% in North Carolina. So just as Dana's discussion in the last session suggested that the Latino vote shift was very significant in the Obama victory. The other demographic that was super important were under 40s, who are having a different, a fundamentally different media experience, in part as a result of the merger of comedy and political information. So I'd like to, in the final defense of Jon Stewart against this charge of cynicism leveled by Rod Hart, I'd like to call Jon Stewart as a witness. And I'd like to read you a bit of a commencement address that I think speaks to the authenticity of his particular brand of humor. And this was at his alma mater, William & Mary, in 2004. And he told the graduates, let's talk about the real world for a moment. You know, we were discussing it earlier, and I kind of wanted to bring this up earlier, but I guess this is as good a time as any. I don't know how to put this, but I'm going to be blunt. We broke it. So please don't be mad. I know we're supposed to bequeath the next generation a world better than the one we were handed. So, sorry. I don't know if you've been following the news lately, but it just kind of got away from us. Somewhere between the gold rush of easy profits and the arrogant sense of endless empire, we heard this kind of pinging noise, and then the damn thing just died on us. Yes, I'm sorry. But here's the good news. You fix this thing, you're the next greatest generation, people. You do this, and I believe you can. You win this war on terror, and Tom Brokaw's going to be kissing your ass from here to Tikrit. And even if you don't, you're not going to have much trouble surpassing my generation. If you end up getting your picture taken next to a naked guy pile of enemy prisoners and don't give the thumbs up, you've outdid us. We declared war on terror. We declared war on terror. That's not even a noun. So good luck. But after we defeat it, I'm sure we're going to take on that bastard ennui. So here was a challenge that Jon Stewart issued in one of his election broadcasts right before the 2004 election. I'm a comedian who makes fun of what I believe to be the absurdities of our government. Make my life difficult. Make this next 4 years really for me. I bleep that out. And in a way, I think it took Americans another 4 years to do it, but they did, finally. And Rod, finally, I guess I would say this. Hey, it's only comedy. Lighten up.
Thanks to both of you for really extremely entertaining presentations. On the one hand, we've had Rod Hart give us basically a sort of commencement address that ends with, you know, the 10-point list for how to live a good life, don't be cynical, really important, and then Lance tells us that comedy is okay, you know, it's good to be funny. And somehow these guys are supposed to be having a debate, which is it's a challenging thing. Two things on cynicism. A colleague of mine told me that he used to be able to go into a classroom on American politics and get a laugh by saying, Jimmy Carter. That's all he had to do, Jimmy Carter. People don't even get that today. They don't understand why that's funny. They don't think that that's a remarkable thing. But at that point, that particular audience believed that it was hilarious. Jimmy Carter was such an object of scorn that simply saying his name in a classroom would elicit laughs. Lance says that Jon Stewart doesn't cause cynicism, and he hands down wins the YouTube-a-thon here. I mean, he's got, on a clip basis, it's just, you know, I'm blown away. You've really got this thing down right. It seems to me, Lance, that you have there are two kinds of big issues that that you're getting close to and not really coming to grips with. And issue number one is that in fact, both of you may have something to say about this. Is the question about television news, right? Why does television news leave people feeling bad? Why doesn't television news enlighten people? And I think, in fact, the big question for me is, why has television news been so bad in the course of, say, the past administration in terms of providing us the news that we needed to know? The second part about the viral videos and the blogosphere is really interesting, and the emphasis, the spread of these things, the enthusiasm for them is fascinating. What it seems the question underlying this for me is the one of basically the selection effect. It's that aren't we really the hope of a TV broadcast medium is that we share some kind of collective life together. But these more narrow audience participation mechanisms, I suspect, tend to be fairly narrow and self-selected, and people don't expose themselves to viewpoints that they that disagree with their own. And so what we're doing is we're building sort of larger reinforcing systems that reinforce whatever tendencies toward cynicism that may be there, or reinforce whatever political views may be there, or whatever misinformation may be there. And so the issue that I'm interested in having you both talk about isn't there a problem? And the problem is that that we are diminishing the degree of the extent of our collective life, and that loss of collective life is the real issue. It's not that there's cynicism or that there's humor. It's that somehow through this process we are diminishing our collective life.
Can I? Have we diminished our sense of collective life? I think that's a really, really interesting question. And what I would suggest is that the shift from passive mass media that targets content badly, often at passive audiences is actually receding into the background demographically. And the rise of participatory media networking is re-engaging people in really important ways. And so I think that we have a revival of collective life through the network society that's engaged by participatory media. So I see that as kind of an optimistic future. In terms of why are people disconnecting from news, and why did the news miss so many stories, especially during the Bush years, I think it's the same reason. People sense that journalists are being spun in a way that's their job. And the hope is that you get spun by two sides, and then you present those two sides, and you have done your job. And in the Bush years, the Democrats didn't have a side or weren't willing to present it very forcefully. And so they were spun by the Bush administration principally, and spun rather badly off course. So people sense that the news is managed, and that is something that they can't really evaluate. What's interesting about the middle question of the 14, and I'll pick one of the middle questions, about the idea of people then selecting the realities that they prefer out of all the possible reality choices available to us. There are two things I'll say about that. One is, yes, there is that tendency, and I think it may be a problem, although what we know is that people who actually try to find both sides, there are those amazing people who are looking for both sides, who are looking for competing information, more often than not become paralyzed and unable to act. So it's really the partisans who find information that motivates their righteous action who end up participating in politics. So there's a paradox of information and action in there that I think is important to sort out. So it's not just simply that we need to be more informed and debate with each other, because often that dialogue leaves us kind of debilitated. But the other thing is that in the networked media society that we are now all part of in one way or another, the 6 degrees of separation principle holds. It's not that hard. It's true that you may dial up your favorite partisan blog, but it's easy enough to figure out what the other side is saying.
You're not that many degrees of separation removed from the other side. And it's very clear that there is movement across the divide. While people are still trying to get their partisan position lined up so they're able to take action. So I think that that's sort of the way that works. It may not be ideal, but it is politically expedient for many people.
Let me just respond to a couple of things. One of the points made is that political performance actually went down empirically, and therefore people felt the need to feel cynical. You know, and I'd submit to you that from the beginning of time, you know, politicians have performed at about 27% of capacity, and that's probably been a constant, and that's probably, they're probably maxing out. And that's simply life itself. So I don't see any particular, we had Vietnam, we've had all sorts of things in human history, and the problems that politicians deal with are the ones that all of us don't want to deal with, the really, really hard ones, like how to shelter and clothe a nation and how to defend the nation against its enemies. I think it's basically been a 27% performance, and as a result, nobody gets a break to suddenly get cynical because of some empirical reality, in my opinion. You know, the thing I hate about political scientists is they're always using facts to back up their arguments, and I thought Lance showed that in his presentation, I think a couple of things I want to say about Stuart. I really dislike him. And the thing that he was doing there that Lance heralded, Stuart is making us cynical about journalism, and making us cynical about politics at the same time. Cynics are against institutions. And about, if you go to the museum in Washington, D.C., which I recommend that you do, it has all kinds of high-tech gadgets. But the most powerful display is a wall that has the pictures about that size, probably about 3 inches by 4 inches, of all the journalists who have died in combat or natural disaster situations, trying to bring a story to the rest of the world. And so to me, the Crossfire example is doubly cynical because it attacks two institutions at the same time, both of which we need desperately. And speaking about new media, I submit to you that almost all of the new media are parasitic on the old media. They've got nothing to say. They say things about the things that the old media have said. And I'll give you a fact. I don't even know if it's a fact. I'm going to treat it as a fact, but I think it's probably hearsay. But a friend of mine went to high school with John Stewart, and he said he remembered him vividly, and he said he was always the guy that was picking on the fat kid. And I ask you to just think about that as a potential fact. And to me, that fits perfectly. And if you had to think back about high school and you had to think about which person around the world that you know would pick on the fat kid unmercifully, it would be John Stewart.
Hearsay. Let's open it up for questions. So we have two microphones.
I wanted to ask, is the current controversy over leadership of the Republican Party between Rush Limbaugh and the RNC, is that funny?
It's hilarious. It's the funniest thing that's happened since Sarah Palin. It's funny in the sense that I think Jon Stewart may have gone over the top with his OxyContin riff on Limbaugh last week. But on the other hand, when you do have a party that seems to be running as far away from the rest of the American people as it can, you have to point that out and ask what's going on. And I think that this isn't a time. It's clear that Obama has taken the high road on all of this, as he should, and I think the American public has credited him with that. But someone needs to ask, what the hell are they doing? And I think that this question of how many Republicans need to apologize to Rush Limbaugh it does raise the question of whether he's the leader of the Republican Party. And humor has brought that question out more clearly than other media.
I also note that Rush has put on a lot of weight. And I think he's going to explode.
I wanted to question a bit, lumping together Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart, and Bill Maher. Maybe it's the humanities, textual, rhetorical part of me, but I think they have very different stances, very different targets. I think that Jon Stewart, in the case we've been talking about here, on Crossfire, he does want us to be cynical, not about the institution of journalism, but about those journalists and others of their ilk. Stephen Colbert embodies the right-wing bloviators, and he wants us to be cynical about them by in the way that he embodies them and their behavior. And Bill Maher, you know, strong libertarian, wants us to be cynical about people who would use religion for social control. And also, I mean, he's one of the strongest, he's one of the rare voices of atheism, you know, anywhere in the media. And also he wants us to be cynical, and he does want us to be cynical about people who want to use the criminalization of marijuana for social control. So I think they have very different approaches, very different stances, targets. So I just would like that to be recognized a bit. It's not just, you know, one mob of nattering cynics here.
The thing I hate about humanists is that they're is they're always using nuance and miscellaneous anecdotes to make their point. I think that's really thoughtful.
I think it's really thoughtful too, and actually it helps make the point that comedy is not providing blanket condemnation of all institutions that we should hold sacred. It is singling out the failures and foibles in those institutions and helping us look at them in a way we might not be able to look at if we were just looking at them straight-faced and serious. Comedy has a way of deflecting the pain of examination of these kinds of topics. And I think that that needs to be applauded. And so these comedians do single out different kinds of foibles and failings. And they don't blanket condemn all institutions. Certainly, Jon Stewart has had many journalists on his program and really engaged with them and presented their views in ways they might not even be able to present them in their own news programs. So I think that we have to be careful to not do what Rod's suggesting and say that they're really condemning all of our sacred institutions.
Do we have time for one more? That's a very cynical comment on your part. Join me in thanking these two guys for a really fascinating talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.